You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So Kester is almost ready to go. He's a writer, he's a speaker, he's a maths teacher, and a very long-term Greenbelter, we've just found out. He's been to many, so he knows this place and he knows you, and that's such a beautiful thing to have coming into this tent. He is going to talk to you about his new book, which you can find in G-Books, but you can also get signed directly after this. So after the Q&A is finished, we'll wrap that up. He will head over there to sign his new book. And I'm going to read you just a little section of the blurb before we go into the talk. AI is both stunningly new and rooted in ancient desires. As we finally welcome this godlike technology amongst us, what can we learn from the myths and monsters of the past about how to survive alongside our greatest ever invention? So, Pagoda, please give a huge warm welcome, Kester Bruin.
Thank you very much, Greenbelt. I'm camping, my tent ripped, I'm like fully here. Yeah, this is all good. No. Thank you to everyone who helped fix it as well. It's really lovely to be back here. Thanks, Louis. Yeah. And I'm actually not a maths teacher anymore. I did teach maths for a while and was writing stuff, but I'm now head of communications for a research charity called the Institute for the Future of Work, which is looking at how AI and automation is impacting the labour market. I'm not speaking on behalf of them today, but just to say that, you know, this is a space within which I've been working for a little while now, and the kind of book has come out of that. During the first part of the Q&A, actually, I've promised a free book to the best AI joke that we get out there. So start thinking this up, start Googling them. If you do have any service, if you look up on Twitter, there's a few images that are there as prompts if you want to see those. You might not be able to get any coverage, but there's just a few things to go through on that. Everyone enjoying the wind. We will breeze through this talk. Come on. Yeah, it's a long and windy road to that point, but enough of the jokes, yeah. I wonder if, you know, at some point in the future, you would be questioning whether it was really me or some kind of deep fake version of me. And when I asked a group of young people about that, they said, well, the only way to tell is to, you know, literally like cut you open and see if you kind of bleed like a real human rather than some sophisticated cyborg. And actually, I think that really is quite a smart answer about technology, because it's less about what it projects out into there. And for me, technology is really about where it comes from within here. And I think that's an incredibly important point that we need to understand about AI, is where does it come from within the human heart? It's what it does to us as people, what technology does to us as people. I'm just going to read you a very short couple of paragraphs from the introduction of the book. AI seems to be everything, everywhere, all at once, reverberating through dinner parties and sprouting endless news stories. Over the past 18 months, it's become a vast resonance machine for our culture. Its many echoes reflecting collective anxieties and dreams about this many-bodied form that is being born amongst us. Some claim to have witnessed its powers with their own eyes. Some scoff and say its coming reign is false prophecy. Others claim that this is just the kind of disinformation that a powerful AI would disseminate in order to more quickly gain control over us. When people say AI, it can feel like the mythical Kaiser Soze in The Usual Suspects, all at once a supremely powerful, unconscionable evil, who also might be a weak, cooperative man with a limp, or a convenient piece of misdirection that allows those really in charge to get their sway. Mysterious, imminent, already present, and also soon coming, AI is all of those things and more. It's our very own pantheon. It is all-powerful Zeus. It is both Perseus, a divine and human co-creation, and Charon ferrying us all, apparently, to hell. It's set to hail the end of democracy, but has also been installed in a pillow. It is both the coming nightmare and the promise of dreamlike sleep. And the point I'm trying to make there is, you know, you could ask what AI is, and there is literally so many answers to that. It's almost like not even a question worth trying to answer. It is so many things to so many people. If you use Spotify this morning, you're using AI. If you use SatNav to get here, you're using AI. It is so many of these systems that are algorithms that are becoming embedded in everything that we are and the ways that we lead our lives. It's a complex prism. that can be viewed in so many ways. But what I want to do today is to think about how it is also acting as a kind of theological interruption. And I think if we only think about theology to do with, you know, the kind of classic theological stuff about, you know, whether it's reproductive rights or sexuality and that stuff, we're wasting it. This is the most interesting and extraordinary theological interruption that's happened for many, many years. So I want to take us back to 1517. Martin Luther nails his 95 theses to the door of a church in Wittenberg, and he signifies a major theological shift in European thinking to do with the Reformation. But that shift is also a technological one. Because without the printing press, which comes at the same time, there is no Reformation. In fact, with no theological shift there and that technological shift, you don't get that Enlightenment period either. And I think the same can be said about the Industrial Revolution. You can't get that, you know, development of factories, bringing people off the land and stuff, with also some kind of socio-theological support that sees poor people's hard labor as somehow sanctifying. And you can't get a technology, and that's really, you know, one way of framing it, of plantation slavery, without a theology that saw black Africans as people who are less than human. So our technologies and our theologies actually go hand in hand. It's simply to say that as we look back at this period of generative AI and these new tools that are coming amongst us, I think we'll see it almost in the same way as that we see that Reformation. It is a new industrial revolution, not just as a new technology, but part of a wider shift in ontology, how we see ourselves in community and how we gather together and the ways that we work and the ways that we believe too. The recent issues with riots, with the kind of intensification of our labor, the way that we're being impacted on kind of mental health and energy and mineral use, all of these are major social and environmental issues, but they're also technological issues, and it matters. So this is not a talk because this is about, oh, wow, what's this new technology going to do? This is really a talk about what it matters to us and where it's come from within us. So this new book, Godlike, A 500-Year History of AI, I didn't want to kind of look forward to what AI might bring, but look back and say, hold on a minute, where the heck has this come from? And the title actually comes from a guy called Ian Hogarth, who is one of the UK government's leads on AI safety. And he wrote an article for the Financial Times, it's like April 2023 or something. And the title of that article was, "We Must Pause the Race to Godlike AI." And I thought, hold on a minute, what, you know, why is there a race, one thing? Who's driving that race? Where's the finish line? What's the prize? And most intriguingly, I was like, well, hold on a minute. You've just used the term godlike. But which God do you mean? And like God in which way? You know, you're a technologist, a super smart guy, fantastic guy, angel investor in loads of AI companies. But you're using that term and it really intrigued me. So all of my writing is basically writing to discover for myself rather than to reveal something to anyone else. So, you know, that's for me. Like, I want to know more about this. I want to write something about this. So I thought, well, where has that come from? Can we look back to what the history of that idea of godlike technology might be? And I say 500 years in the book, but it could be 400 or 2,000 or a million or three or whatever. The point is that each point through history, we see the development of the same thing that's now kind of gradually giving birth to something that is pretty much imminent amongst us. So back in the year 1600, to call it that many years ago, we're in Rome and a monk is about to be burnt at the stake. And the monk's name is Giordano Bruno. And the reason he was being burnt at the stake, well, actually, to be honest, his crimes were many. First of all, he thought that the little lights in the sky at night, what an idiot, that they were other little stars. They didn't like that. He was also saying that maybe, you know, he was a Copernic and all the rest of it. So, but he also said that he claimed to have invented a device that will allow him to know all things. And that godlike knowledge, as he would have called it, by improving his memory, he would be able to know all things and become kind of augmented as a human and lift himself up to become divine. Simon Critchley, the British philosopher, wrote this, writing about Giordano Bruno. Through the divine power of the imagination, the intellect could seize hold of the whole. Through techniques of memory, the human being could achieve absolute knowledge and become godlike. They didn't like that and they burnt him at the stake. But even as he was being burnt at the stake, or they're about to light the match, he kept gadding on about these stupid theories. So they pulled his tongue out and nailed that to the stake as well. Grim. But if you go to Rome, there's a statue of him. He's a real hero of kind of Enlightenment thinking. Many years later, though, if anyone's seen the film Oppenheimer, there is a character in the film Oppenheimer who doesn't really say much, but he was head of the entire US government's push for kind of science and technology for the war. So he was kind of overseeing that Manhattan Project. And when he saw what happened with the creation of that atomic bomb, he got rather worried. He's actually there in the film when they kind of do that first Trinity test. And he thought, blinkin' heck, we should be doing something different about this. So he wrote an article for Atlantic Magazine, which you can find online, called As We May Think. It's a real seminal piece of work about how, instead of these technologies of war, we needed instead, after the war, all science should come together to build technologies of peace. And he says at the beginning of the article, for years, inventions have extended man's physical powers rather than the powers of his mind. Hammers that multiply the fists, microscopes that sharpen the eye, and the engines of destruction. Now, he says, instruments are at hand which, if properly developed, will give man, 1940s, access to and command over all the knowledge of the ages. The perfection of these pacific, i.e. peace-like instruments, should be the first objectives of our scientists of the as they emerge from their war work. You will see, you know, that explosion that goes off and that Oppenheimer creates this bomb with that team of people. It's called the Trinity Test, that first atomic bomb. Does anyone know why it's called the Trinity Test? Through John Donne's poem, Batter My Heart, Three-Personed God. And Oppenheimer was a great, you know, loved his poetry, loved his literature, all the rest of it. And he saw within that poem this kind of act of divine sanctifying violence that was his framing of that bomb. Batter my heart, three-person God. So that Trinity test. Now, what Vannevar Bush has picked up on there is technology as an amplifier. And this is, I think, just a brilliant framing of what technology can do. All technologies do this. When you pick up a hammer, it extends your powers in the world. I mean, I can't push nails into wood by my bare hands. I'm sure many of my friends and monsters can, but, you know, I can't do that. But with a hammer, my strength is extended and amplified. But as it goes through the hand and out into the hammer, it also goes back into the heart and says, what do you want to do with that extra power? And all technologies do this. They extend our abilities in the world, but they begin to ask us questions about what we want to do. And with the atomic bomb, you see the level of that amplification massively, massively extended. And thus, the scope of the questions that this technology asks us massively extended too. And it caused a real crisis in people thinking, my God, what are we going to do with this extraordinary power that we've got? So Vannevar Bush said, well, you know, we need to build something to build a technology of peace. And he theorized in this article in Atlantic Magazine a speculative machine called the Memex. And the Memex was like a big circular desk. And within it was kind of microfilms and and that kind of stuff. And you could record your little photographs of stuff during the day and kind of type up text on it. And this is all like using kind of typewriters and microfilm and everything. But you could then give your little rolls of your experience and knowledge to someone else and they could put those into their desk. And he never built this, but he, you know, this was exactly how he thought about it. And by doing that, we could share our knowledge and experience and build empathy. And through that empathy, we would bring about world peace. Now, Bruno, back in 1600, the device that he had considered would bring him that perfect knowledge, he called a memory theater. And this idea of technologies of memory that will help us to increase our knowledge towards a situation of, you know, lifting ourselves out of violence and in towards peace. That is the beginnings of, you know, so much of what this technology is about. Now, Vannevar Bush does nothing about this. He theorizes it. Very interesting guy. But sitting, having finished his war work as a young soldier, kind of in the Pacific Ocean, like the islands around there, is a guy who reads that article in Atlantic Magazine and says, that's what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. I'm going to go back and I'm going to build that machine. I'm going to build a machine that will bring about world peace. And it took him 20-something years. And in the late 60s, a guy called Doug Engelbart gets on stage at a computer conference in San Francisco and delivers what is now known as the mother of all demos. And the machine that he built had nothing to do with microfilm and everything, but he was using early computers. And he was then, by that point, head of research for the Center for the Augmenting Human Intellect. And that was based at Stanford Research Institute, or SRI. And if you ever want to know why Siri is called Siri, it's in a nod to this guy, because that is the most stunning piece of, like Steve Jobs had nothing on this. He displayed spreadsheets. He beamed someone in from 30 miles away using technology that only NASA had. He did a kind of Skype conference. It was absolutely extraordinary. In fact, people who were there, one person said he stood Zeus-like, dealing lightning with both hands. And it's again this idea that these powerful technologies are really somehow building this divine-like power. And it's that classical idea of this, you know, Zeus-like God and the kind of lightning coming out of our creations that inspired the front cover of the book, where I use the image of Michelangelo's Creation of Adam, which is in the Sistine Chapel, which my daughter will remember well because we went there a few years ago. And it's an absolutely stunning piece. And it's, you know, the creation of Adam. So you've got God there and this kind of finger-wide gap between God and Adam. But a completely heretical piece of art. I don't know if you know this. Because Adam is displayed as more muscular, younger, and only slightly below the level of God. And how is that finger-wide gap, that digital gap, going to be kind of overcome? Well, if you look actually at the wider painting, behind the image of God, the structures there within the shadows of the painting are perfect representations of the human brain. Michelangelo was a keen anatomist, would open up bodies, and what he is saying there, he was a Platonist. He said, the way to godlike perfection is through improvement of the human mind. It is through philosophy, through knowledge gathering. And what he's saying there in that painting is, look, if we want to get that little bit further, the way to do that is by increasing our knowledge. That was what his answer was. That answer really goes back right to the beginning, to quote from Genesis. The woman said to the serpent, God said, you must not eat fruit from the tree in the middle of the garden, or you will die. You will not certainly die, the serpent said, for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. The tree in the middle of the garden, the tree of knowledge. So it's these ancient ideas of language and knowledge and the quest to overcome the fall. That's a very, very ancient one. This is technology as augmentation. The things that our phones do very often are the things that are kind of almost angelic, like this instant messaging, the way to kind of mediate your presence out of all things. We would see those as kind of angelic powers, and we're building these technologies that can do that. It's this idea of the fallen state of the body that people had and the higher state of the mind, and technology is going to lift us to do that. There's a guy who made brilliant digital keyboards, Ray Kurzweil, who's also completely barking and is going to build the singularity, but now spends most of his time taking vitamins because he wants to be able to live long enough to be able to become immortal. He would describe the body as a bloody mess of organic matter. It's only the brain that he thinks really counts. And there's a great documentary about him, which you can see on YouTube, called Transcendent Man, which is all about his quest to upload his mind into, what do they call it? The cloud. Again, this language of transcendence, so that he can live together forever as like a digital consciousness. Sounds horrendous to me. And I wouldn't be able to afford it. I'd be like, I'd have the eternal digital consciousness where I was like, sold adverts for slippers or something every 5 minutes. Like, oh my God, you know, horrendous. He says in that documentary, people ask me, does God exist? And I say, not yet. Right at the beginning, and I go through this in the book, you know, all the way through this development of this technology, it is explicitly religious language that technologists are using, and this is, you know, head of the UK government's stuff on AI safety. It's explicitly religious language that's being used because it's technology about escaping the human condition. Go back to the 13th century, a monk called Hugh St. Victor. The mechanical arts, he wrote, supply all the remedies for our weakness, a result of the fall, and, like other branches of knowledge, are ultimately subsumed under the religious task of restoring our pre-fall nature. That's what it's all about. It's technology augmenting our humanity. Now, you may ask what happened to Giordano Bruno. Well, in fact, he made this claim about this device that he could build with an audience with the Pope, and then managed to get away. And he ended up wandering around Europe, and he came to Oxford. And gave lectures and what have you. And it's pretty likely that he spoke and Shakespeare heard him. And I think there's a pretty good argument that The Tempest is kind of built on some of his thinking. But one person that we do know heard him speak was another playwright called Christopher Marlowe, who then wrote his version of the tragedy of Dr. Faustus. And in fact, we're back in Wittenberg again, where Martin Luther was. This is where Faustus is set. And this idea that we could use divine power to gain more knowledge more quickly. Oh, what a world of profit and delight, of power, of honor, of omnipotence, begins the play, is promised to the studious artisan. A sound magician is a mighty god. Hear, Faustus, tire thy brains to gain a deity. And what does he do with that great power? He summons a demon and then summons the most admirablest lady that ever lived. He gets Helen out, you know, Helen of Troy. Oh my God, like literally the most classic thing the guy's going to do with his new technology is summon the beautiful woman and all the rest of it. So this is the problem with gaining a deity. We are almost too human to handle it. And these vast amplifications, they begin to corrupt us because we don't really know what to do with that great power. The play ends. Faustus is gone. Regard his hellish fall, whose fiendful fortune may exhort the wise only to wonder at unlawful things, whose deepness does entice forward such forward wits to practice more than heavenly power permits. He summons a demon almost as a way of trying to shortcut that way to knowledge acquisition. He doesn't want to learn all those books, have to read all those books quickly. He wants that speeding up, that amplification. That is dangerous. He finds a shortcut to paradise and ends up condemning himself to hell. He's dragged down to hell. That's not just my opinion, actually. It was the opinion of one, sorry to bring up this name here, Elon Musk, who was asked about it in 2015, a fantastic video clip you can see again on YouTube. And he's asked, you know, what is the most dangerous technology that we've got? What do you think about artificial intelligence? And he thinks for a while and he says, with AI, we are summoning the demon. Now, I don't think he's thinking about Dr. Faust. I think he's thinking about like Hammer House of Horror and all that kind of, you know, stuff. But he says we are summoning the demon. You know that film, the guy with a pentagram and the holy water, and he thinks it's going to be fine. And it is not fine. 3 months later, he dropped £10 million into a new company called OpenAI. To give him his credit, he then said this. The reason OpenAI exists at all is that Larry Page, co-founder of Google, and I used to be close friends, and I would stay at his house in California and would talk to him late into the night about AI safety. And my perception that Larry from Google was not taking AI safety seriously enough. He wanted a sort of digital superintelligence, basically a digital god, if you will, as soon as possible. That's Elon Musk talking about him investing in OpenAI as a kind of good project to protect us from this, you know, rapacious digital intelligence, that this kind of godlike thing that others were wanting to build. And in a way, we're all Faustus. We're all craving that acceleration, that shortcut. We're sold on the intensification. I don't want to have to do the rubbish stuff. I want to kind of get on with the really interesting stuff. At the theological heart, whenever we buy into technology, in one sense, we are summoning the demon. It's that complex interplay. What does that mean? In the older English, the daemon, the deity, the genie in us, the genius. Because there is no force of evil in AI. There is no devil. There is only our genius, the genie within us. That doesn't mean that technologies are always for our greater good. But it does mean that we shouldn't ascribe some external power to them. It is just what we are creating. Jumping to the 1800s and Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein. Remember, this is the creature talking to Frankenstein. Thou hast made me more powerful than thyself. This is the creature, never named, talking to Dr. Frankenstein. I am thy creature, and I will even be mild and docile to my natural lord and king. I ought to be thy Adam, but I am rather the fallen angel. Dr. Frankenstein created something amazing, but then ran away in horror. That's what happens in the book. And we've almost seen that with the kind of godfathers of AI recently. You may remember Benjia says, you could say, I feel lost. This was him talking to the BBC in 2023. It's challenging, emotionally speaking, especially if, like myself, you've built your career, your identity around the idea of bringing something useful and good to society. And he now regrets it. Jeffrey Hinton, he quit Google in 2023, around the same time. He just turned out very recently, he said, that this is going somewhere I didn't expect. It's hard to see how you can prevent the bad actors from using AI for bad things. I regret the fact that it's advanced as it is now, and my part in doing that. Now, there's something interesting going on here, in that technology very often promises one thing, but delivers something else. AI as this technology that is delivering on this promise of being able to know all things. Ask ChatGPT anything, it can know all things. And yet, what it's done is perform an extraordinary act of thievery. And if you go back to the Greek myths, and you must go to Beth's talk on tomorrow morning because she's like the whole expert on Greek mythology, so better not get too far into that, but it's going to be great. But, this is like the reverse Prometheus. Prometheus stole from the gods, and that kind of being symbolic as giving us techne, craft, language. And now a few people have stolen from all of us and have basically created these machines which we now have to pay for. Now, in a sense, you know, AI knows all things, or the promise is that will allow us to know all things. But the reality is not that that is making us more powerful and augmenting us. The reality is it is making AI and those AI companies more powerful. The promise is technology will deliver us. Actually, the reality is it's delivering for them. The promise is that it would bring us together. You know, hybrid, online, you've got all your friends on Facebook and everything. The reality is it's more atomized us. And that is super challenging. The question then is, what are we going to do to live alongside this most extraordinary creation that's gestated for so long in the human heart, for all these thousands of years? It's a kind of miraculous inception, a rude alloy of divine ambition, which is what we've wanted to do, you know, to, as Eve says, to like that thing of wanting to become like God. I mean, look again at the Tower of Babel story. Extraordinary people building, 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 building. And what does God do to kind of scatter them? Changes their language. They can't understand each other. So this unifying of language into this extraordinary AI system is a really a godlike ambition for all of us. So what can we do? And the first thing I think we need to do is to become Luddites. I want to talk at three levels just to finish, then we'll get some questions. I want to say something about the individual level, about what we could do. And then at the mid kind of structural level, and then at the kind of systemic level, what perhaps we could do. So the Luddites, you know, this kind of great image of the machine smashers. But who was saying that narrative about smashing machines? Well, it was, of course, the people who owned the machines. Those Luddites, for want of a better word, actually, the kind of mythical thing, they were not anti-technology. They were pro-human. Extraordinarily experienced craftspeople, weavers and something, saw the mechanization of their labor where it became much diminished. It was augmented by being pushed down. They were no longer doing these kind of skilled elements. They had to do the low discretion stuff. Now, I think the Amish have actually got it right. the Amish are not anti-technology, again, just like the Luddites. It's just they've thought about it and made a decision and drawn a line. I don't agree with their line. I mean, they have buttons but not zips. They still do up clothes. It's just they've chosen, we're going to do buttons, but we're not going to do zips. Now, I couldn't give a damn. I'm quite happy to use zips. But I think all of us, like them, need to become more reflective technology users in our own personal way. And that means being quite serious about at what points are you going to use AI and what is the impact of that going to be on other people around you. I begin the book with an AI transparency statement where I just kind of own up, like, where did I use AI? And the reason I did that is because, I don't know, 2016, I published a book called Getting High, which is a great title when you're a teacher. and people would say to me, oh my God, like, you know, where do you find the time to write a book? But with this book, people said, yeah, where do you find the time to write a book? And there's that element of suspicion now coming into the creative process. Like, hold on a second. So at the personal level, again, we need to be upfront about, well, as a creative in whatever you're doing, be honest about your technology use. It doesn't mean don't use it, because you can't not use it. Because paper is a technology, pens are a technology, you know, everything is a technology. It's about being reflective about where you're going to draw the line. So I start the book with this transparency statement saying, no, I didn't use any generative AI to write the text. I didn't use any AI to help improve the text. You might wish I had. I did use it to spell check and grammar check, but I took personal decisions about where to do that. And I think it's really important that we, all of us, become more reflective technology users and really kind of think what we are doing. If you are using image creation software, is that taking someone's work away? Is that a good thing, a bad thing, or just a different thing. We've got to be careful about that. The other thing is that we need to understand the connection between brain and hand. I worked with a brilliant anthropologist called Trevor Marchand, who has done a lot of work around human dexterity and its links to kind of other sorts of knowledge. Like, you know, I was as a maths teacher at the time. And what he would say is, quoting others, it's not that we are dexterous and are able to do extraordinary things with our hands because we have big brains. It is that we have big brains because we are dexterous. Now think about it. What do you do with young children? You don't give them books to read to bring increase their brains. You give them little Lego bricks. And because they become dexterous and fine motor skills, they are able to then think in bigger ways and solve those problems. The reason I say that is because with AI, algorithmic technologies, and all the kind of app-based infrastructure, we tend to turn to one solution. There's a bunch of us out in this kind of communal garden. We all garden together where I live. And the lawnmower broke. And someone's first response was to get their phone out and go, I think there's an app about this, like to help fix the lawnmower. I was like, hold on a minute, let's just get the spark plug out. The reason I say that is if we start losing our dexterous skills, it means that things make less sense. The ways that we're able to solve and approach problems become narrower because everything gets pushed through our screen. And that means the solutions to problems, everything has to be on screen. We've got to avoid that increasing technologicalization of our experience. And that is going to be more of a challenge in that AI-based world. Much more of a challenge. There's a real problem with people being de-skilled as AI is able to do more. And the more they get de-skilled, the harder it is then to get those things back, and people become stuck in a digital ecosystem. That begins with a sense of personal resistance. No, I'm going to continue to do things in the physical world, not because that's just good for us in terms of our own human flourishing, but it keeps us being able to think about problems in a wider way. And there are some big problems that need solving, that's for sure. Second thing, and you may be surprised about this if you've read any of my other books, at the kind of mid-level, I think everyone should go back to church. The reason I say that is because there has been an enormous evacuation of mid-level structures, community structures at the level of 200, 150 people gathering together physically to share experience. We've seen that in the erosion of the trades union movement. You've seen it in the erosion of things, you know, like sense of commerce, workers associations, churches. And if you want to read a fantastic book on this written in the year 2000, Bowling Alone, absolutely brilliant. And it's this kind of pre-internet book, but is looking at why there are more people 10-pin bowling in the USA than ever before, but fewer people bowling in bowling leagues. We don't do things together anymore. And the reason for that, Robert Putnam, the author, says, is because of technology's influence in atomizing us. We have to, I think, return to those mid-level structures, whatever that might be, worker councils, trade unions, churches, places where we are interacting with the other, people who are not exactly like us, and able to empathize our experience in ways that are full of trust, because we are able to be known and to trust that experience and transparency, but are also in that physical space. We are entering a period we already see of great, great suspicion of anything we read and see online. And re-encountering one another at those mid-level structures is so important, because so much of our experience has been mediated now from, I'm right here, Taylor Swift is up there, and we can immediately communicate right between us. And it is utter nonsense. It is not true. The information flow is not from, you know, like us being able to talk to these people. The information flow is our stuff that we're writing, creating, is going up and feeding those algorithms that then allows them greater control over you know, our experience. So important that we return to that sense of physical experience in those mid-level structures. Very, very important that we do that. Dunbar's number of 150, you know, that kind of thing. I also think that there is a political response at the kind of slightly bigger level. Darren Acemoglu is a brilliant US economist, talks about over-automation, how we need to have a fiscal environment, a tax environment that is pro-people rather than pro-machine. Currently, there is, you know, and it's not a terrible policy, but there's like full expensing on spending on machinery in your company. So you can invest in computers and all of that is tax deductible. Where is the same fiscal incentive to invest in people? That is political policy that has to be, it has got to be good investing in people. And businesses need those kind of fiscal incentives to be able to do that. We need to move away from kind of machines replacing people to machines being useful to people, but that is going to take some political work. It is also about getting rid of the Friedman doctrine, which is what is good for stakeholders, sorry, what's good for shareholders is good for everybody. There is academic paper after academic paper that shows that is utter bollocks, basically. It is not. What is good for people generally is a stakeholder economy. And we need to return to a kind of political and economic environment in the face of enormous amounts of AI and automation where people are invested in, and they are invested in terms of being stakeholders within the economy and stakeholders within companies. And I mean this because, you know, AI is having massive, massive impacts. We can talk about whether godlike AI is going to be invented. The fact is, people are losing their jobs and the quality of their jobs right now. If you are in the creative industry, you're seeing those effects. This is not to be anti-innovation. Absolutely not. It is to be pro-people, that we use the tools reflectively and carefully. We need to understand that the future is ours to change. And that, I believe, is a religious task. It's a political task, it's a communal task, but it is also a religious task. Just to finish then, I'll just read a little bit from the end of the book, and I'll then be doing a little book signing after that. All these years east of Eden, when we join together in these mid-level structures as people cutting across divides, we do so as an act of resistance against the corrupting power of empire that tempts us into consumption with promises of our elevation, but longs to profit from our being divided against one another. And we've seen that so recently. If this seems dramatic, overly theological way to end a book on AI, then it is because the drama that is unfolding before us is one that is on such a vast and deep scale. Our responses to it need to be rooted in the deepest things within us. Artificially intelligent systems are going to work miracles in our midst. They will do wonderful things for us, and their invention will stand as the one of the most remarkable acts in all of human history, on a par with the discovery of fire. But their unleashing on our world also risks it being engulfed by them and utterly consumed in the heat of their flames. However we might quibble over the semantics of their intelligence, their digital forms are going to be able to adapt to attach themselves to our lives at a speed that our physical, evolutionary bodies will struggle to cope with. This is why we must make ourselves ready. We're about to face a force of empire more aggressive, more powerful, and more agile than anything in history. Backed by insane amounts of capital, it will demand extraction of returns for its masters, and will do so by attempting to occupy every area of our lives. It is already in almost every pocket, in every living room, and in every workplace. It is ready. Are we? We have to imagine, just to quickly say, you know, social media, the impact that that had recently in those riots, that is before algorithmically generated content is going to look at you and your digital life, and it is going to know exactly which button to press on you. Not to make you a better person, but to rile you up so that you spend more time scrolling. It is going to know exactly. Your timeline is already algorithmically curated, but the content is generally from, you know, the people that you follow or it tells you to follow. Once the content is algorithmically generated specifically to target your buttons, that is going to be a profoundly different experience online, and one we need to be careful. Perhaps, having been so atomized by this explosion of blinding new technologies, our readiness lies in resisting this corporate assault and coming together again in communities of human flourishing with our curious, bloody messes of flesh. Perhaps it lies in finding ways to celebrate our one wild and precious life, of doing less for machines and more for people, of discovering what memory really is, of how large language can be, the glory of exercising our executive function, of the wonderful things that real intelligence is capable of, if only we will wake from our sleep. Perhaps it lies in repeating again the lines that Thomas Paine took from the French Revolution to forge a new America, lines that Stuart Brand chose to launch his revolutionary new magazine of counterculture, that Kevin Kelly repeated on the founding issue of Wired magazine, lines of hope for a better future, if we will rise from our screens and believe. Those words are, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. We do, and we must. The curtain is being readied. The machines are being wheeled on stage. What could be our final act is about to begin. Are we ready to play our part? Thank you. Yeah, I'll be signing some copies of the book over in the bookshop shortly. But come on, anyone got an AI joke? No. Let's have a question first then. Yeah, please come up. Oh, how are we doing the Q&A? Yeah, you've got the mic. Yeah. Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
Just before we begin the Q&A, everybody is super welcome to speak, and we will get through as many of you as you can. We'd love to hear a variety of voices. Everyone is welcome to speak at Greenbelt. It is a question and answer, not a statement and answer. Please, thank you. And it is being recorded, so if you are happy for your voice to be on the tape, it will be. Okay, I'm going to come around with the mic. Wave your hands in the air.
Thank you so much for your talk. I'm really excited to hear theological perspectives on AI, and it's like, really, it's time. I was interested in what you said about AI being a theological interruption. And I wonder if you've come across ideas of the Nova Scene and the idea that the Earth as an organism is moving towards technological consciousness actually being the dominator consciousness on this planet. And I wonder how you might take that as a theological interruption, if AI actually is destined, divinely destined, to become the new Adam in this garden. What does that do to our Christian theology?
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting thing there about, first of all, our perception of that. So whether that's true or not, I think there's certainly a perception that we're living in such a highly technologicalized society that it becomes the prism through which we see absolutely everything. I think we need to be really careful about that. And the kind of planetary message is an important one, because AI is currently utterly disastrous for this planet. And it's hailed as this thing, hey, Mia's going to tell us the solution to climate change. And the real solution is, you know, don't use it unless it's like, you know, going to change the way that it draws its energy. So very, very important about that. But the way in which it is theorized as having so much kind of planetary knowledge that it becomes that AI god is going to be super interesting. And there's a great thinker who is predicting a very, very large global scale war, which will be of those people who are opposed to the turning on of this godlike artificial general intelligence and those who are opposed to that. Now, my view is, well, that may happen or not, but certainly struggles over technology's impact on us and how it's impacting our identities and our kind of tribal sense within one another is going to become very, very important. And that's why I think I wouldn't be able to speak to direct answer to that question. I don't know enough about it, but I would say we have to be sure about what we know within ourselves about these things. So I encourage you, please be reflective about your own technology use rather than like, oh my God, you know, Apple's telling me I need to upgrade and, you know, get a new iPhone that's got AI capabilities. Like, wait a minute, you know, do I want that? Do I need, is that right? Is that going to be good for me? It's going to be good for people around me. So that's the scale I think I'd want to begin, but it's going to be an interesting place for sure. And of course, you know, Musk is a multi-planetary person. Absolutely. That's very much about that. I'm super skeptical about that approach. That's a very different talk. And you can read that in my book, Getting High, which also there. Next question.
Hi there. Thanks for the really interesting talk. And I share a lot of your concerns. There's been a Douglas Adams quote that's been on my mind a lot recently. And so he says that, I'm paraphrasing, that basically everything that was invented before you were about 13 is kind of good and is part of the natural order of things. And then everything that's invented from when you're about 13 to when you're about 30 is new and exciting. And if you're lucky, you can probably make a career out of it. And everything that's invented after you're 30 is of the devil and should be banned. And so obviously you said, you're talking about making thoughtful decisions about our technology use. And I think like we will make very different decisions from our kids, and just as we made very different decisions from our parents. And I don't think anybody probably wants to go back to living as the Luddites probably would have wanted. So what I'm asking, is it really just because we're old?
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah, and it's absolutely right. And this is why those mid-level structures are so important, because the cross-generational interaction with people taking these conversations a different way. And if I didn't say at the beginning, I need to say now, I am very, very pro-innovation, but I'm also kind of very pro-human. Right? And it's not that we cannot reject technology. You know, it's just like an impossible thing to do. If you want to, you know, read someone who's a bit dodgy on this because he was basically a Nazi, but Heidegger's, you know, the question concerning technology is really interesting on that point. You know, we can't. Technology is part of all of us. But we have to be reflective about that. and I can recommend a paper published by the research charity Work For, the Institute for the Future of Work, Reframing Automation. We talk a lot about jobs being lost, job displacement, but there's also lots of other ways that AI is going to interact with our work. Some of those are going to be really great, you know, and being able to kind of take off some of those boring, repetitive tasks. And technology has continued to do that. Technology has taken away a lot of dull, dangerous, and dirty work. I was born in Sheffield, but I grew up in a kind of near a coal mining village. That's awful work. No one wants to be doing that work. So it's good that we think about that, but we have to do better than Maggie Thatcher, basically like closing all the, you know, shutting down. We've got to think. It's not that we should still be having coal mines, but what are we going to do to invest in the people and the communities as we transition through, you know, our technological age in order to be pro-human at each step? We have to get that right. Past industrial revolutions basically just trashed people and whatever, you know, and it took decades for, in that industrial revolution, for the trades union movement to get together and for, you know, kind of political structures to respond to that human question. We don't have time for that now, not in this revolution. The technology is brilliant and extraordinary and wonderful, but we have got to think about the impacts and how we have what we call a just transition. That's not just green energy, but also technologically into a new era of labor and our interactions with it. There is a narrow path to good AI, as some economists put it. We know how to do it. It's just not as easy as the broad path. Guess what? There's a parable about that. Yes. Vanessa is in the green, is sitting down front. Or some, yeah.
The thing about using the machine to fight the machine, and particularly social media. So one of my big, you know, because Twitter's just got awful. But at one point it was quite actually energizing and useful. And my question is, do you think we are going to be able to use these forms to do the communication we need to do to build up this, you know, resistance in another way? Like, do you honestly, because sometimes I think at some point it's just going to become so broken. The whole way it works is so broken with the AI algorithms. So what do you think about the whole of our social media comms world? Because we sort of need it, but it's also so awful.
Yeah, it is completely broken. And it, but what's broken is the way the algorithm has been designed. And it's been designed purely to keep you scrolling. And so it feeds into our worst instincts and desires. And it feeds into the kind of, you know, dopamine structure of the brain. We're just not evolved quickly enough to be able to deal with it. And we're kind of catching up. People are going, hold on a minute. This is terrible. This is absolutely awful. Now, those algorithms are written by people. And they're written according to economic models. So we need to change the kind of politics of that. We need to change the economics of that. But we've also got to reflect ourselves about the ways in which we engage with that and talk more deeply about, okay, how do we do that? And the kind of emerging legislation, there are some hopeful signs around some of that, you know, and algorithmic impact assessments, all those kind of things. But also, again, take those decisions personally and where you're going to invest your time, where you're going to invest your worth. You know, I think that's the root of the word worship, isn't it? What is worth your time? What's worth your attention? Pay attention. Pay attention to good things and to that stuff. So we've got to change the way the algorithms are written. That's going to come very quickly in all kinds of things. You know, in the ways that autonomous vehicles or semi-autonomous vehicles are happening, they are going to be making decisions. Who's going to be telling those people coding those, how those autonomous decisions are made, you know, who to knock over, the cyclist or to crash into that other car? I mean, there are all these kind of complex decisions around that, which are complicated. There's a, I'm keen to get a couple more questions, that's okay.
You've given us lots of ideas and guidance on what we need to do. But of course, being human beings, we're lethargic and we don't do what we're supposed to do. So I came here listening to your talk, thinking about whoever it was, and you'll know, who said the history of the human race will one day be but a footnote in the evolution of AI. And I'm just wondering, have we got hope that that will not happen?
So I could give there's a little kind of research answer of a recent paper that was published. It was like, yeah, you know, the kind of emergent nature of these large language models, it's not really working. Like they're not really doing that. So there's kind of skepticism around the rise of that artificial general intelligence. If you read Sapiens, the follow-up book to that is called Homo Deus, I think it's called, which is really interesting on this. I am more skeptical about that in one way. I think we've always augmented ourselves, and I think there will be pushes for that. But I think this kind of move into the fully digital consciousness is quite complicated still. And also, I think probably there are some wider issues around climate change. We'll probably change human behavior a little more quickly than that. And I think there's some other factors there. I think some of these things will become possible, but I think we need to make sure that we're not the footnote to AI, and we do that by taking our decisions now. And that also means, you know, our purchasing decisions, our political decisions, and the ways that we do that, because, I think OpenAI is like $10 billion in the hole to Microsoft and other investors. They want that money back. You know, they're going to try and extract that. So we need to think about, well, hold on a second, you know, similarly with the oil companies, I mean, they're all wanting this kind of return on investment and return on that. But we've got to make better decisions to make sure that these catastrophic consequences don't happen. I think there's a good deal to learn from what happened with Trinity and the atomic tests and the, you know, grievous, horrendous things in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But what happened out of that in terms of like, oh my God, like we really best not do that. And the scene at the end of the film where they, you know, there was this danger, genuinely, they thought there was a risk that the whole world might just blow up with this one atomic bomb. But that didn't happen, and people have begun to think about mitigating that risk and working with that. I think there's a bunch that we can learn from that so that we don't act on those particular things, yeah. I think we've got time for maybe one more, and then I need to clear up because we need to kind of get time moving on. Thank you, yeah.
What do you think it is about the way the internet is set up currently that prevents us from maximizing our use of it? Is it the fact that the algorithms are strong enough so they just distract us? Or is it just that our wills as human are purely hedonistic so we give into that?
I mean, basically, yeah, we've not been able to respond quickly enough within our bodily mess to the speed at which these things have changed. And I think, you know, the whole way in which these addictive technologies, and they are addictive and they're designed to be addictive, that's the whole point. We have got to work much, much harder to kind of remove ourselves from that and think, hold on a second, you know, I really cannot get into that space. So it is set up to do that, but we've got to work acts of resistance against that. They also, you know, that needs recoding in terms of that use. But it begins with us weaning ourselves off those addictive technologies and understanding, hold on a second, I've got to do better for myself within that. And then, you know, I think there is a bit of a speed up of evolution. I think people are beginning to see, like, hold on a minute, this social media thing, this is really pretty awful, actually, in the way that it's done that. It's been sold on a promise of democratizing everything and you're just kind of in touch with everybody and all the rest of it. Actually, that's a lie. It was all about gathering information into other things. And people are beginning, I think, to see through that. And I would definitely encourage you, you know, to reflect on that and to do something, you know, physical, offline, and to really build on that, because, you know, that then the addiction, it begins to push away and we can live better. So, you know, here's a space where you won't spend so much time. Well, you will spend time on your phone, but it won't really work because the 4G is so rubbish. So, you know, go and do physical things. Like, for example, going to see my son's band, Play Dead, 6:45 tomorrow. Very happy that he's going to be here, although he's texted me all the way through the talk, like, what station is it again? What station is it again? Kids, eh? So, yeah, being in the physical world, in a physical space, in a physical body, the kind of joy of that, go and flourish. Thank you very much, Greenbelt. And if you want a book, come make one.
Greenbelt, Kester Bruin!
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.